Mitch Albom is an internationally renowned author, journalist, screenwriter, playwright, radio and TV broadcaster, and musician. His books, beginning with Tuesdays with Maury, have collectively sold more than 35 million copies. Mitch was born in New Jersey and in early years wanted to be a cartoonist, then a musician. He attended Brandeis, majored in sociology, but stayed true to his dream of a life in music. After graduation, he performed in Europe and the U.S., including a gig at a taverna on Crete, where he attained notoriety singing Elvis. In his early 20s, while living in New York, he became interested in journalism and volunteered at a local weekly. He returned to grad school and earned a master's from Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, followed by an MBA from Columbia School of Business. Mitch began working as a freelance sports journalist in New York for Sports Illustrated, Geo, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. His first full-time newspaper job was at the Fort Lauderdale Sun-Sentinel. He moved to Detroit in 1985, where he became a nationally acclaimed sports journalist at the Detroit Free Press and one of the best-known media figures in that city's history. He's worked in newspapers, radio, and TV. He currently hosts a daily radio talk show and appears regularly on ESPN, Sports Reporters, and Sports Center. In 1995, he re-encountered Maury Schwartz, a former college professor who was dying of ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. His visits with Schwartz led to the book Tuesdays with Maury, which he wrote to help pay Maury's medical bills. It spent 4 years on the New York Times bestseller list and is now one of the most successful memoirs ever published. He went on to write The Five People You Meet in Heaven, For One More Day, and Have a Little Faith, titles that were turned into TV movies. Today, we'll speak with him about his new title, The First Phone Call from Heaven. Welcome, Mitch. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report.
Thank you very much.
How did the idea of The First Phone Call from Heaven come to you?
Well, it was sort of inspired by the preciousness of the human voice. That was sort of my theme, which is kind of how I write my books. I sort of think of a theme that I want to deal with, and then I think of a story. And I had been kind of moved by the fact that about the time that I was conceiving this, my mother suffered a really bad series of strokes that left her without the ability to speak. And I haven't heard her voice now in 3.5 years. And she's still alive, and I can hold her hand, even though I'm not sure she knows it's me. But she can't talk, and she can't acknowledge me. And I miss that voice so much, and it really got me thinking about how the voice is how we really connect to people, even though we talk about pictures and seeing them. But it's the voice. It's why people save answering machine messages when someone dies, and they hang on to them. So I decided to create a story that was really centered around all that human voice connection thing, and I invented this little town in northern Michigan where one day the phones start ringing out of the blue, and it's people calling from heaven, just their voices, and they're telling people in the town that they're okay and what it's like and all that, all their loved ones. But it only happens in this one town, no place else on the planet. And news leaks out, and people start pilgrimaging to this town, and everybody wants to be a part of it, and the media starts getting a hold of it. And meanwhile, there's a guy who lives in the town who's kind of brokenhearted. His wife died, and he's raising a son on his own. And one day, the boy comes home with a toy telephone and says, "When is mommy going to call us?" You know, because everyone in the town is talking about this. So he gets very enraged that someone is filling his son with false hope. And so he decides he's going to prove that the thing is a hoax. And the book becomes like a collision course between him trying to prove it's a hoax and everybody else trying to prove that it's real.
One of the phone call recipients shares her mother's description of heaven. She says, "It's beautiful. The pain we suffer is a way to make us appreciative of what comes next." Yeah. That is so comforting.
Well, I'm probably looking for some things of comfort, both in my own life and for the people who read my books. But, you know, we often wonder when we go through agony down here, what's the point? And I like to think that, you know, the pain and everything that we suffer here, you always hear about people who have those near-death experiences. They always say, "I felt so much lighter, you know, everything dripped off of me. I couldn't feel pain anymore. I couldn't feel worry anymore. I was at total peace." I don't know if that's true. I've never had one of those experiences, but I like to think that it's true. And if so, then heaven would be, you know, more of the same.
You write in the book, fear is how you lose your life a little bit at a time. That really resonates.
Yeah. And the last sentence of that is, what we give to fear, we take away from faith, you know. And I think that that's true. There's an old expression that says, you know, if you have faith, you don't need to worry about fear. And if you fear, then you don't have faith. And I would figure that heaven is kind of the ultimate proof that your faith has been rewarded. And so somebody there would probably be likely to have that sentiment, saying, you know, all those things you're afraid of, which really, what are we mostly afraid of? It's the end, you know, and everything up to that point is kind of like, well, I'm afraid I'm at the wrong job because I'm only going to have X amount of time in my life, and then I'm going to die, and I don't want to be the wrong. I'm afraid, you know, I'm not going to have kids, and I'll be worthless, and nothing to matter in my life because I'm just going to. If there was really a heaven, every problem that we hold up as significant would totally fade away, because you'd be aware that there's this whole other era yet to come. So that's why one of the characters, when she gets a call at the very beginning from her sister, and she's telling her pastor about it, and he thinks, you know, you're upset. She says, I'm not upset. I'm not afraid of anything anymore. And that's exactly, I think, how most people would feel if they really, really had some kind of proof of the afterlife. So that's why I said what I did about fear.
And do you personally believe the end is not the end?
I do. I don't think that we're here to become worm food. I think that there are too many stories about people who sort of take a step in that world and then come back, that suggest that there's a soul. Too much of a feeling of unified humanity, the human connections that we have with one another, the ability for people to know when something's wrong with a loved one, even when they're not talking to them. These are things that are out of the body, you know. They have to do with connections that we make, and I don't think that that stops just because our body stops.
All right, changing tacks for a little bit, from the Lucky Tiger Grease Stick Band to the Rock Bottom Remainders. How did you come to join that hallowed group?
Well, hallowed is a pretty big name. I was in Norway with Dave Barry. It was 1994. I was covering the Olympics, so was he. I was a professional musician. I mean, that was my heart's desire, was to be, you know, in music, writing or singing or producing or anything. And ultimately, it didn't work out for me as a profession, but it remained the love of mine. And so one night in Lillehammer, Norway, we were kind of hanging around at 3 o'clock in the morning because the deadlines were, you know, so different. And there was a piano in the lounge. And so I wandered over to where I started playing. And Dave Barry came over and said, I didn't know you played bad. I said, yeah, I told my whole story. And we started singing up all these oldies songs, because I was in an oldies band. So I know every song from 1955 to 65. I mean, I know every song. And we started singing with some of the security guards there. We were singing The Land of a Thousand Dances song, you know, na 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 na, that one. And by the time we were done, Dave said, you've got to join this band that we just formed. It's called the Rock Bottom Remainders. You know, we don't have anybody who knows the kind of music like you do and plays the piano and everything. So next time we came home, I went out, and I've been in it ever since, 20 years or whatever. Yeah.
You play keyboards?
I play piano keyboards, yeah.
Okay, here's a question I asked Dave Barry.
His answer was much funnier than mine, but go ahead.
Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
To the best of your knowledge, has anyone in the Remainders ever screamed more cowbell?
No, because most of the Remainders don't know what a cowbell is, and only the drummer actually does, and he's a real drummer, so he would never actually scream more cowbell.
All right. So, Mitch, after the, you know, amazing success of this book, do you already have your next project rolling around in your brain?
Well, actually, it's funny that you bring up the music thing, because my next novel, which I'm beginning to work on now, is actually going to be set in the music world. It's the first thing I'm going to write that ever has anything to do with music.
When will that be out?
As soon as I finish it. They want it next winter, but we'll see about that. That might be a little too fast for me.
All right. Well, Mitch, thanks so much for stopping by. I really enjoyed the book. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for reading it.